recorded at the Southwest Conference on Botanical Medicine in April of 2012. For more information on our conferences, lecture notes, and recordings, visit our website, botanicalmedicine.org.
So pathological factors. So we talked about kind of more constitutional patterns within Chinese medical system. And here we have, I just threw up some of the main kind of pathological factors. And the pernicious influences that David was talking about this morning. You know, you have your wind, damp, cold, and heat, dryness, and summer heat. Those are the main pathogenic influences from the outside. And these are more like factors that are inside the body, pathological factors. And they can be derived from those external influences or some kind of combination thereof. But blood stagnation, like I said, that's the key one for cancers, tumors, things like that. Phlegm, it's a different story, but can still lead to different types of tumors, that, you know, that really condensed form of fluids. Damp heat, we're going to talk about that a bit and what that manifests as and what causes that, where dampness and heat have combined together. So two pathogenic factors that are, when they're combined together, they're much more detrimental, harder to get rid of. And like David was talking about this morning, damp heat with wind. You can have a wind damp heat or a wind cold dampness. And those are two different kinds of B syndromes, like different kinds of arthritis. Someone had osteoarthritis, they could have a cold or they could have it hot. And you want to treat those two people differently. So these kind of things we tease out. And then heat toxins is another thing we'll kind of hit on a little bit deeper in the talk here. But literally the toxins that are generated from that kind of hot effect. It could be a hot constitutional internal condition, or it can be something that you could have gotten a flu or something. And, you know, everybody's always talking about the difference between, you know, we had this, like David said, there was an old germ theory that came, you know, long ways back, the worms that grew inside of the body, all these different kinds of worms that caused some kind of a outbreak in the tissues or some kind of a manifestation of disease. And then if you go back way back into traditional Chinese medicine, deep in the history, everything was about the ancestors. You know, the first part of it was that if there was a problem, if you had a disease, you had to appease your ancestors. That's how their medicine was, you know, very early on, that's what they focused on. And then at some point further than that, there was more of like a demon kind of a theory, where there was some kind of a demon that was inhabiting your body, some kind of a spirit, and then you had to chase it away. And like acupuncture kind of was like, you know, spears to chase away the demons, you know, from your body. And then eventually it got into sort of what's going on with the ecosystem? How does the ecosystem of the body look? And what are the factors from our outer ecosystem that affect the ecosystem of the body? So when you look at these things, these are changes in the body's ecosystem that then, if you looked at them in a microscopic level, you'll find changes that we can identify within the biomedical field. And for damp heat, you talk about bacterial infections, often give you a damp heat kind of condition. Heat toxins can be, you know, it can be other infections, it can be cancers, autoimmune diseases, a lot of them have heat toxins. And phlegm can be things like we were talking about the dampness picture, the cholesterol, the hypertension, all that kind of stuff. And then the blood stagnation picture, where you'll find coagulation products in the bloodstream that are very high, fibrinogen, D-dimer, plasminogen activators, and those are things we're going to talk about in this lecture. So, blood stagnation, tumors, growths, and clotting. So blood stagnation occurs from different causes. You know, one of the causes it can occur from is, of course, a trauma. You know, if you traumatize the tissue, you get a big bruise there. Well, that's the blood stagnation. You know, the stagnant blood in that area, you know, you've got extravasation, blood enters the tissues, and then it turns purple when it oxidizes. You know, you see it, it's this bruise. Outside of that, you've got a little bit of bilirubin, like we're talking about before, too, in the bloodstream, and that's that yellow color that comes around the outside of there. So you've got that kind of, that's part of the blood stagnation picture, an easy way to see it, how it kind of plays out in the body. But at the deeper levels of the body, it plays out in different manifestations. Stagnant blood often follows what we call stagnant qi. And so, you know, they kind of, in Chinese medicine, they always talk about how qi is the governor of the blood. And so in order for the blood to be pumped through the body, there's got to be qi in the muscles. There's got to be qi in the heart muscle, qi in the muscles surrounding the vessels. All of that has this energy that's pushing the blood through the body. When that energy is low, the blood doesn't move as smoothly. It's easy for it to get stuck. One of the other ways to think of it is if you had a river where there's a big, you know, a lot of blood flowing through it, and a lot of water in this case, it's not going to get blocked. The river's going to push boulders out of the way. If it's a big river and it's really flowing fast, a lot of qi in that river, right? The river really rips through things. Trees will come down, boulders will move aside. But if there's not a lot of qi in it, if there's not a lot of blood in it, so the river's really small, you know, something falls into the river and it changes the whole course of the river. And the river could pool and pond into some kind of little bog or something that happens. That can happen in the body too. So the blood stagnation also, when there's trauma to the internal tissues, you often get a stagnation of blood as well. So when there's damage to the endothelium of the blood vessels, you'll get this little bit of damage that happens there, and then blood starts to get stagnant because either the vessels can occlude or there can be a change in the permeability of the tissue. Like a lot of times blood will extravasate and it can't get back in. And then we have the idea that the spleen, that qi energy that's supposed to be moving the blood, if the spleen qi gets real weak, the blood vessels don't hold the blood in the vessels, and the blood starts to leak out into different areas. And so you get like spider veins and the, you know, telectasias and the, atelectasis, and then you get the little bits of, you know, just kind of bruising that happens really easy in people. And then also stagnant blood will start to form in those areas where the redraw of the toxic blood doesn't happen. So the blood that's there is oxidized. It's got a lot of kind of byproducts of the oxidative life process of generating ATP and so forth is sitting there in the tissues. Well, that's not a good thing. You know, we want that system to flow real smoothly. Blood comes in and out of the tissue capillary beds, and it keeps moving in the body in a real smooth way. And so qi stagnation being the first part, and if we think about that spleen dampness picture, you've got that goopy gumminess, the phlegminess, the dampness, all that stuff slows the qi down, slows the blood down, and you end up getting stagnant more easily. And that's one of the things that leads to this, you know, kind of cancerous growth in our society, and how that spleen damp picture leads to tumors and growths in general. So cancer is a coagulopathy. You guys ever heard that term? A coagulopathy. You know, when a cancer gets bigger than 2 millimeters, it's got to supply itself with its own blood supply. It's got to create its own vessels via angiogenesis. Because it's so inefficient at making energy using just the fermentation process that it has to start supplying tons and tons of fuel in order to burn it, because it's burning it very inefficiently and with a lot of cost, a lot of off-gas, a lot of, you know, just really ketones and lactic acid that's being produced. So the coagulation is where around the cancer, everything that the cancer is doing to change its environment is directing it to get more blood in that area and to get, you know, more resources and to slow down that oxygen process so that everything could get kind of more anaerobic. We call it glycolytic. Some cancers are very glycolytic. They really make a lot of sugar into a lot of nasty byproducts and a little bit of energy. So that's the coagulopathy. And then hypercoagulation is what the cancer does to the body, it does to the bloodstream. So anybody who has cancer, they'll have a 7 to 10 times high risk of having a stroke, because they're going to be making clots. Cancer makes clots. It's just what it does. And you can imagine how cancer is changing the chemistry inside of our body, is changing the ecosystem. It wants the blood to move sluggishly. It wants there to be stagnation. It wants more oxidative biological end products. That makes cancer grow. So what we're always trying to do is get the blood moving, invigorate it, you know, get the blood oxygenated, you know, get hyperbaric oxygen, for Christ's sake, you know, get some oxygen in the person. That's all really helpful to break up that coagulation. But we'll see that the hypercoagulation picture is a huge part of what I look at when I'm looking at a patient with cancer, or it could be another coagulating disorder. You know, it could be a heart disease patient as well. But how you identify, you know, sort of some tangible outcomes, some tangible measures to say, hey, this is elevated. We're going to use our therapies, and let's bring those numbers down and see that this person's risk is now lower. That's one of the things I want to get into. So the clotting factors, I'm just going to go right into the fibrinogen, D-dimer, and plasminogen activator inhibitor 1. These are three of my primary ones. Fibrinogen is the precursor to the formation of fibrin, right? And fibrin is basically the long fibrous material that the body makes to harden up clots, okay? So whenever there's a tissue damage, the body's going to build a clot to seal it off. The fibrin binds into platelets. The platelets come together and form their clots. So that's their job, right? They activate the platelets, and then they stick together, they aggregate, and then the fiber makes them harden, and that creates the clot. That's what's happening on the endothelial lining of the blood vessels as well. You know, the big cause of heart disease as well is because people are damaging those blood vessels as they're getting this oxidative damage from the sugar. Then they're kind of layering in this coating of this little clot that goes over there, which makes the blood vessel a little bit smaller, a little occludes it, it thickens the endothelial lining, and we know that process goes on and on, and you get this, eventually you're more and more likely to have a clot. So fibrinogen is that material that is the precursor to the formation of fibrin. There's something called thrombin. Thrombin interacts with the fibrinogen, activates it, turns it into fibrin. You guys follow that? Pretty simple, but that's the clotting cascade and how the body starts to create these clots. So D-dimer is a peptide, okay? Kind of like we talked about C-peptide. C-peptide is cleaved when you're making a molecule of insulin. Well, D-dimer is cleaved when the body digests a clot. So when a clot is being taken apart, D-dimer is these pieces, these big peptides that are being chunked away. So when you measure, when D-dimer levels are always going to be at a certain, you know, there's a baseline. It depends on your lab value, but they should be at a pretty steady state because the body is always in a balance of having a little bit of inflammation, which is, you know, precious to us, having a little bit of coagulation. It's always going on. But when you get into hypercoagulative states, you can see that with these markers, the fibrinogen and D-dimer especially, you can predict outcomes for people. And it's, you know, they're very predictive in cancer as far as outcomes of mortality, and they're very predictive in heart disease as well. And if you go, you know, if you're in the ER, someone comes in with a, you know, some kind of a quick heart condition, it looks like they're having a heart attack, D-dimer is going to be one of the first tests you're going to run. Then plasminogen activator inhibitor. Plasminogen is what we use to digest the fiber. So plasminogen activator is something that we, it's a compound that's used to activate this breakdown of clots. And the inhibitor, PAI1, there's also PAI2, but it's only present in pregnancy, but PAI1 is specifically there to inhibit that breakdown. So it makes the clot stick for a long time. So there's certain things that we have that can target either one of these, you know, pathways. Although this one right here is just anytime you break down a clot. And when you get into tumors and things, D-dimer levels can be really hard to read because breaking down a tumor is just like breaking down a clot. It's breaking down the coagulopathy, the coagulation. So the D-dimer level can be high, and that can be part of the process of just taking apart the tumor. So if someone is on chemo or they're doing a heavy-duty botanical therapy, the D-dimer level can vary, so you have to be a little careful with it. But if you correlate all things together over time with tumor markers and so forth, you can see how people are progressing. That's that stuff. So the fibrinolytic system I was talking about, tumor growth, invasion, metastasis, angiogenesis, cell migration. All this stuff depends on this fibrinolytic system, and cancer manipulates that system, just really heavily manipulates it. The prognostic value part of it, that's the part of it that's really interesting, because you won't find many, you know, medical doctors or oncologists, you know, routinely running these tests. It's just not really done. It's sort of like, okay, you got cancer. If it's from the breast, well, then we know that it's breast cancer, so we're going to treat it with, you know, Adriamycin, Cytoxan, and Taxol. If you've got prostate cancer, we're probably going to tell you to get your prostate removed and then maybe give you some radiation or give you a triple hormone blockage therapy. But that's just, there's no identification of, well, what kind of breast cancer do you have or what kind of prostate cancer you have? Is it aggressive? Is it not aggressive? And that's the first step for us is, what are we dealing with? Because cancer is thousands of diseases. And what kind do you have? You know, and that's the first part. And this is a part of that for us. And this is something that as herbalists, we can get a lot of traction in, is the hypercoagulation area, because we have a lot of great therapies to affect these pathways. So clot formation we talked about. If any or all of these are elevated, and sometimes you'll find that the PAI1 isn't a big factor, but you'll often find if someone has active cancer, those numbers will start rising. Fibrinogen especially. And fibrinogen becomes one that's very predictive. Chemotherapy oftentimes, especially if it's, you know, if you're breaking down cancer, if you're breaking down tumors, you also have all this clot formation. And sometimes, you know, people die because they broke down their cancer too fast. If a therapy was really well targeted and the cancer just like broke apart really quickly, the tumor lysis can be too much of a burden and the person can die from that. It doesn't happen so often because normally the tumor populations are so heterogeneous that, you know, your therapy only hits a certain population. Some of them grow and grow into something else, then you got to put your next layer onto it and it keeps going like that, which is the scary thing about cancer. But we got to know what's with the person that we're dealing with, what cancer do they have and how is it manifesting in them? Identifying a cancer by, you know, whether it's in the breast, or whether it's in the prostate, whether it's in the bones, or wherever it is, if it's in the brain, that's just such a ridiculous way of identifying cancer. Like we talk about breast cancer, but I mean, there's so many kinds of breast cancer. You know, some of them have estrogen receptors, some of them don't. Some of them have progesterone receptors, some of them don't. Some of them have epidermal growth factor receptors, some of them don't. Some of them have human epidermal growth factor 2 receptors, HER2 new. Some of them don't. How do you know about that? And some of them have a really aggressive tendency to proliferate. Some of them have mutated suppressor genes. It goes on and on. If you don't, I study that stuff and figure it out, you're just kind of going, okay, well, you have cancer, I'm going to put you, you know, just on these drugs and we're going to see what happens. That's not the approach that I tend to take with people. These are just some research here, just as far as just kind of backing up what I'm saying, that fibrinogen and D-dimer, look at, they're just directly associated with problems in cancer, whether it's the disease progression or if it's mortality, morbidity. So these are actual, you know, lots of good research coming out on these, and why it's not being used more routinely, I'm not exactly sure. Sometimes it's just easier to go with the kind of status quo. You know, if you have a person with breast cancer, they get this therapy. You know, that's kind of the way it is. It's the this for that approach. So plasminogen activator inhibitor, produced by the liver. Most of these compounds are coming from the liver. You know, fibrinogen is being made in the liver. PAI1 is being made in the liver. also high in atherosclerotic lesions. Correlates with increased body mass and high plasma insulin levels. So, again, back to that spleen damage picture again. How many levels is that affecting us on? How deep is that going as far as our disease process? And you can see here that when the person has that elevated insulin, hyperinsulinemia, the hyperglycemia, it leads to problems and changes in the chemistry of the person, in the ecosystem of the body. And one of the big places is this thing right here, this plasminogen process, the process of breaking down the fibrin, gets inhibited. Okay? Does that make sense to you guys? I know this is kind of dropping in a lot of Western side of things, but are you guys getting it? You guys still with me? Okay. Sleepy after lunch and all that too? Boy, I just go right at you guys, huh? What was that? What were you passing out? Some kind of cell integrity? No, was it? He's got some kind of super-powered thing. We should pass him out here. Okay, so here's some ideas, some therapeutic examples of blood stagnation relieving herbs. Okay, blood stagnation also, you know, it's really, in Chinese medicine, any pain is a manifestation of stagnant blood or stagnant qi. So when energy can't move through an area, it hurts. And that's, so one of the things is anybody who has pain, we're always thinking of, you're going to look at the class of herbs to remove blood stagnation or invigorate the blood or break up blood stagnation. A great example, you can really follow blood stagnation is in women around their menses. You know, if women have more blood stagnation, you get the clots are more formed, there's more purple blood, there's dark color blood, there's, you know, stagnant blood starts to manifest, and you can see it. It's actually, you can ask all those questions to a woman. It's really informative for you, and painful periods, you know, where they just get really a lot of cramping and stuff. Again, that's stagnant liver blood, stagnant blood in the reproductive system, or stagnant qi, or both. So just wanted to clarify that, you know, I'm talking about blood stagnation in the context of tumors and the formation of cysts and that stuff and growths, but it's also a big part of Chinese medicine overall in understanding the pain process and just, you know, disease. A lot of diseases begin with stagnation of energy. At the top of this list, you've got a couple of herbs I talked about, the Dongguei. Remember I said the Angelica sinensis was both a blood invigorator as well as a blood tonifier, key factor. Ligusticum, that's a really wonderful one. That's considered like one of the key qi tonics. And that's the main headache herb. And anybody who has a headache is always going to get some ligusticum, because headaches in Chinese medicine are always developed from some kind of stagnant energy, you know, qi stagnation in the head. And ligusticum goes to the head and invigorates the qi and moves the qi and moves the stagnation. Red peony, I talked about white peony earlier. Red peony is just a little bit cooler and a little bit more blood moving, whereas the white peony is more softening to the liver, like I said, a little more soothing. Mudan pea, we talked about that one, a little blood-moving herb. And then these different categories. So the top category are herbs that invigorate the blood. They're just kind of helping blood circulation. These are also herbs that are going to oxygenate tissue, right? As you move the blood, you're going to create more oxygen in the tissue, which is key for keeping people healthy on every level. And then there's the next class is promote blood circulation to remove blood stasis. So once blood stasis has already formed in an area, we got to get a little bit more heavy duty with our therapies. Not that these are real heavy duty, but they're just a little bit stronger as far as breaking the stagnation of blood. Like the top herb there, curcumin, right? That's our turmeric. And most of the time people are using curcumin these days, which is, you know, the three different main curcuminoids that make up that plant. But the plant itself, the whole plant, the 5-to-1 extract is actually really wonderful as well. Great blood moving herb. And it's an herb I'm going to talk about tomorrow as a multitasker, how it has incredible ability to do a lot of things at once. Polygonum cuspidatum, that's the tiger cane or the Japanese knotweed. It's our best source of resveratrol, big compound in grape seed and skin, the one that's kind of been attributed with lots of anti-aging effects, but it's got a lot of great benefits, you know, resveratrol, but the polygonum cuspidatum as a whole is a clear heat and clean toxin herb that has some blood-moving properties as well. This is cardamus, that's the cardamus flower, the persica seed, and this is one of my favorite herbs for blood stagnation, especially in the heart, is salvia miltiorhizum. That's kind of like one of the exemplary blood-invigorating herbs that has a nice action on the heart itself. So this last category, herbs that break blood stagnation, the zetoaria and the rhizoma spargania, those are almost always used together. And then the last one there is the leech. And I'm going to talk about the leeches a little bit further. Okay, these are herbs that have a more direct effect on the actual clotting cascade of the body and influence the aggregation of the blood and kind of keep it moving smooth. So for people that have more abdominal tumors, masses, you know, if people are, you've got endometriosis, things like that, and the beginnings of tumors in the ovaries or in the uterus, these herbs are going to be much more beneficial in that area. And then the leech is really an amazing one that I'll talk about because it has some compounds in it that are used by the leech to prevent the coagulation while the leech is trying to draw your blood, right? So that principle was used by the Chinese doctors a long time ago.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure, of course.
Do you have anything to add to that? You know, I know it's directly an herb, but kelp.
Yeah. Well, and the thing, you know, there's two main types of seaweeds. Other question? The question was, can we talk a little bit about iodine and its role in this process? We talked about iron, we talked about copper, we talked about sugar. How about iodine? And so iodine is one of those really interesting topics, and I love it because I've dug super deep into it now, and I've got a lot of information on it. But there's still this huge polarity. There's the yin and yang iodine camp, right? There's the one camp, the Blumenfeld and those guys that are saying, hey, give everybody 50 milligrams of iodine a day, you know, and the other side saying, don't touch anybody with iodine because they might have, you know, some kind of autoimmune thyroid disorder, and if you give them iodine, it's going to turn their thyroid into a crazy, you know, furnace. And so I don't really take one side or the other on that issue. I find that there's a lot more to the story, as always. Iodine's one of many minerals, and it needs to be combined with the right combination of other things to work properly. In the context of cancer, you know, nodules made of that are more phlegm nodules, they're generally treated with iodine. Iodine induces the mucinase enzyme, which is a mucus breakdown, you know. So like one of the things that Tim Francis always taught me, is one of my AK teachers, he would always say that if people had the plugged up sinus, you'd use iodine because you'd induce their mucinase enzyme system to go and break up that mucus. Also, goiters, scrofula, that's considered a phlegmy nodule most of the time, especially if you feel they're soft nodules and they're treated with seaweeds, you know, part of the treatment. Nowadays, there's all this, you know, these concepts about, you know, the thyroid, especially, and thyroid autoantibodies, and that if you've got, you know, a system that's driving iodine across, it's kind of a complex thing, but iodine in the thyroid gets converted from iodide to iodine, so it can be used in the thyroid tissue, and that's a calcium channel-driven system, so you can use magnesium as a calcium channel blocker for that part, because what you do is each time you make a thyroid molecule, you generate a peroxide radical. So you've got this buildup of these compounds in the thyroid gland. It's the hottest tissue. It's a little furnace. It is. It's burning. It's a fire. It runs the metabolic rate of your body. So it's generating that fire. And if you don't have a good mechanism to quench that fire, then the fire runs out of control. And then the tissue gets damaged. And the immune system gets hot. And everything gets a little crazy. And you get heat toxins in the thyroid. Okay, so how does iodine play into it? Well, iodine is very oxygenating to the tissue of the body, and oftentimes if I'm using like a more directed anti-cancer therapy, I will oftentimes integrate iodine. Iodine is very important for fibrocystic breasts. It helps to, you know, helps to reduce cysts in the breasts. It's also good for cysts in the abdominal area and women's tissues. Iodine is concentrated in the ovaries and in the breasts next to the thyroid. Those are the three highest places. So I also find that iodine, it's important which form you use. Higher doses, I like the saffron-bound iodine from Scientific Botanicals called TriQuench. Otherwise, I start with a real low dose of iodine generally, and I just build up real slowly. And most people do really great. And thyroid problems, to me, they're just not very hard to fix, you know. And it's not just about the thyroid. You got to get their whole system back together and find out their root problem. But the thyroid can often be addressed using some form of iodine, some seaweed, sea vegetable caps, a little bit of liquid iodine, small amounts, though. I might start with, you know, 3 to 5 milligrams, you know, for me, which is way higher than the RDA. But you add magnesium, selenium, sea salt, and extra water. Those things are super important, just that. Selenium regenerates glutathione. It's the key thing. So it's used up in the thyroid really rapidly. Selenium also changes, it pushes the thyroid away from making what's called reverse T3 into making the actual free T3, which is the activating form of thyroid hormone in your body for each cell. There's a lot to that story, you know, but it can be an anti-cancer therapy, actually. You know, high doses of iodine. But high doses of iodine are actually very important for shutting down thyroid function. And in the 1940s, high doses of iodine, that was the treatment for Graves' disease, you know, for hyperthyroidism.
Low doses, would you consider, do you have a preference if they're oral versus
topical? Topical is not really a good idea because the skin compartment actually it's a variable thing. So people always do that kind of iodine test, put it on the breast topically, and then when it go, you know, see how long it takes for it to go away. when you think about the skin compartment actually compartmentalizes the iodine. It is not a true reflection of what's happening in the body. You really need to do a urine iodine challenge to find out how much iodine.
What do I mean? Is it a treatment?
The thing is that, yeah.
Topical
I don't like because I don't know how much they're being absorbed. I don't know if it's getting beyond the skin compartment.
There's no danger in doing oral, as long as you rule out the dangers, like you're overdosing them.
Yeah, I mean, in low doses of iodine in most people is totally safe. And I, you know, just like I said, you need to have the other things in place: a lot of water, a lot of sea salt, magnesium, and selenium, and then make sure that they're, you know, that you build them up real slowly. You know, you don't want to just jump in with 50 milligrams a day. Some people do that. That's what I'm saying. There's certain groups of people that's what they love to do, is just get everybody on iodine. And, I mean, there's a whole thing with bromine, right? I mean, bromine and bromides are now replaced iodine in all of our food sources. So we're getting lots of halogens now that are disrupting our iodine metabolism. So there's just a lot to that story. But, you know, seaweeds are great. I love seaweeds. That's the thing I can always stand by. You have people eat seaweed salads, and it's a great way to oxygenate tissue. It does a good job of that as well. Does that answer that question for you? Think so. Good. Okay. Good. So I want to talk about Herudo. This is the leech, and so there's 14 different anticoagulants from leeches that we know of, and the main one is Herudin, and it's a thrombin inhibitor. So it inhibits that process of converting fibrinogen to fibrin. It's real direct, and it's real powerful. It's kind of like heparin in its way that it's asking. So, you know, enoxaparin or Levonox, one of those, you know, low molecular weight heparins. This is something that you can use as an herbalist. You know, they actually take these leeches, they're actually growing in the, you know, lakes, and they actually harvest them and dry them, and then they're used as an herb. You actually get leeches as an herb. It's pretty exciting. I'm from Minnesota, so I used to put my foot out of lakes a lot, and I'd always have leeches on my feet, you know. I just never thought of them as medicine. I always thought of them as these nasty things. But they have to use this Herudin in the substance in order to prevent the blood from clotting when they're trying to draw blood out of the body. Otherwise, your body will create a clot there. So this is one that, you know, again, if you're not monitoring people, you know, you use the leech as a whole herb again, and it's got all these different components in it. It's very different than just isolating the Herudin and giving somebody a high dose of it, you know. So I use the leech in a lot of blood stagnation removing formulas as a, you know, as a standalone formula, as one part of a formula. I want to talk about fibrin digesting enzymes. These are really, really helpful for us in tumors. Very, very important. Lumbrokinase, my favorite one, comes from the earthworm. And the lumbros, the lumbricals, are the earthworms. And the earthworms live in the earth, and they're digesting the fiber of the earth all the time. They're creating pathways, and they're also helping drainage of the soil. They have this really interesting relationship with kind of getting that damp, phlegmy stuff out of the dirt, you know, so that the dirt can breathe. Hey, Robert. And so that's what it does in the body, too. And it's considered a reliever of wind phlegm and phlegm blocking the channels. So the body is thought to have the meridian system, but outside of that, there are also these small meridians, these small channels. And the earthworm was always thought of as an herb to eat away the phlegm that blocked the small channels in the body. And now we know that it contains an enzyme called lumbrokinase, which digests fibrin. Well, how phenomenal is that? And I'll tell you what, you guys, this stuff works like nobody's business. It's awesome. And it does not push people to bleed unless they're already on, you know, a serious therapy. If they're already doing a lot of warfarin, or if they're on, if they have a lot of radiation damage and they've got a lot of friable tissue in the brain, it's the only time you have to be worried about high doses of lumbrokinase. I've never had anybody have any bleeding issues with this, and I've got, I don't know how many tens of patients I've used this on in high doses. Bromelain is another one, comes from the pineapple, also a fibrin digesting enzyme, has a lot of other effects as well, a lot of anti-cancer, and the natokinase from the, you know, the soy as it's acted on by the enzymes, the natto. Well, there's the lumbrokinase. There's two main forms of it. One is comes from Canada, and it's called Bulaki, and the other one is from Allergy Research. And the Allergy Research product, I have to look again at what exactly the units they have in there. It's like, it's a small, maybe 50 milligrams, but each capsule, I'm not sure. I think maybe it's 50 milligrams per cap. But two caps twice a day is about a good dose, like a good starting dose. I've had people as high as 12 caps a day. So. But then again, you know, I'm dealing with people with stage 4 cancer where it's, you know, it's pretty heavy duty. When someone's got renal cell carcinoma, they've got lung mets and brain mets, you know, and they've got a D-dimer of, you know, 600 and a fibrinogen of 850. It's like, you know, they need to get those clots eaten up in a hurry. So, and this stuff really works well. So degrades the fibrin, also activates plasminogen, and similar to tissue plasminogen activator. So it dissolves the fibrin. That's really a wonderful, you know, factor. Not much does that. And it has these six different fractions with potent enzyme activity. So it's one of those things that, you know, just do a little research on it. If you want more, I have a lot more data on this. Here's just a few research studies to have for you guys. And just sort of some of the research done on the actual fibrinolytic enzyme and how it works. But it's really one of those things that I've just found there's very little replacement for. It's kind of like what David was talking about with the nettle seed. Like, that's a real specific, and it's really something special. It's potent, very non-toxic also. This one's very non-toxic. I would say that talking with Dr. Dwight McKee, he said he has seen a case of, I think it was post-severe radiation. It was like whole brain radiation after gamma knife, a lot of friable tissue. I think it was high doses of lumbrokinase in combination with another blood anticoagulant, and somebody did have a bleed, and it was hard. He didn't know, so he said, you know, just with that one, use a little caution. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that with the drug interaction stuff tomorrow, with ginkgo and so forth, other things. And there's certain cases where you want to be a little careful, but in general, it's very safe. The bromelain is actually very safe. I don't have any problems giving this to anybody on just about anything, any drug. More effects for anti-edema. So people who have edema, you know, you can start to really eat up the extra fluids. They'll help draw the extra fluids out of the joints, edema, you know, ascites, things like that. Always use bromelain. A good dose, always need to have at least 2,400 GDUs, gelatin digesting units potency. And, you know, about 1,500 milligrams to 2 grams dose 3 times a day. That's a really good place to be. And it's got to be between meals for this one. The lumbro is a little bit more forgiving as far as with meals or without. I do it between meals anyway just because I think it's more potent that way. Allergy says you can do it with meals. But the bromelain is specifically between meals because it does digest protein so much that it'll just eat your food. It's used as a digestive enzyme as well. So if you want people to digest better, give it to them with food. If you want them to just have it be in the bloodstream to eat up some of the edema or some fibrous, you know, networks, some tumors, then use it away from food. Anti-inflammatory, anti-thrombotic, anti-metastatic, and fibrinolytic. Tons of great research on this stuff. You all pretty familiar with bromelain? Know about it? Also for sprains and strains, you know, if someone just needs to get something going, they've got a swelling, you know, swollen joint. So this stuff is really great for that too. It helps really break down the swelling in the joints and take it apart.
Have you used it with fibromyalgia?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Although fibromyalgia, I find, you know, most of the kind of surface level stuff it just doesn't get to the root of it. Most people have a deep kind of chronic fatigue syndrome or adrenal fatigue, an essence deficiency underneath it. Kind of got, you know, but it's, you can get little bits of help. Yeah, I normally, I go with the magnesium malate for sure. I do a pretty high dose of that, and then I'll use a botanical formula. Depending on the person, some bryonia maybe, some, you know, semisifuga, those kind of things are good. If it's more nervy pain, St. John's wort, it depends on what the person has. What's that? Low compliance problem, yeah. I just talk really, just growl at them, you know.
Is there enough bromelain in pineapple to make much of a clinical difference?
Not really. There probably is if you ate enough of it, but the problem is you're getting so much sugar, you know. Talk about a high glycemic index and high glycemic, you know, load food. I mean, pineapple is just unbelievable. So, you know, it doesn't really serve us to eat that much sugar.
So, these digestive enzymes, do you say they're getting, like, into the bloodstream?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's.
I can't
see it?
No, I can't see it.
Read the studies in here, because you'll see how the process happens of them getting down, you know, broken down, and then they get absorbed through the duodenal and mucosa. You'll see that there's a whole process of how that happens, because it is one of those things. And some companies will enteric coat their, you know, their enzymes. You can just do a little digging on it. The natto especially has a lot of great research on it, and, you know, and natto's been eaten for a long time as miso, you know, and tempeh, you know, just the fermented miso natto. And it's well known that it is a blood-moving herb and that it does a great job of helping to reduce, you know, clots and stagnation. It's been good for blood stagnation syndromes. And nowadays, there's a lot of folks out there in cardiovascular medicine doing 3 doses a day of natto kinase. You know, basically take your 2 caps, the cardiovascular research, 2 caps 3 times a day every 8 hours. I mean, it's unbelievable how people are going without having any problems with heart disease, you know, I mean, just with specifically clotting, replacing things like warfarin and heparin and, you know, especially warfarin, which is kind of the one that I see most people on. I really don't like people on warfarin. You know, it's one of those drugs. I just had a patient that's been with me for 2 years, amazing guy in his 80s, came in with prostate cancer all through his body, huge, his leg was like this big. I worked on him for, you know, all a year and 9 months. His prostate cancer, when he came to me, PSA was 2,900. His PSA was 21 3 weeks ago, but he was on warfarin, and they got it. And then all of a sudden, now his white blood cells, everything just started collapsing. He's in the hospital, almost died. They had him overdosed on warfarin, and so he was bleeding just heavily, you know. And so it's like, it's just, you know, I'd rather not have a therapy that has such a detrimental side to it. You know, if we can do things without that kind of danger, I'd much rather do that. And I think these things are the way to do it. It's just that the studies aren't there. You know, the idea that how do we get somebody to study nattokinase? You know, what do you got in it for you? Where's your $5 billion payout? It's not there. So how are you going to run the $5 million study? You can't. You know, who's going to fund it? Whereas if you're the guy who makes warfarin and you stand to, you know, gain that much, sure, you're going to throw in $50 million or whatever it is, you know.
I'm wondering, because so many people are allergic to soy, if you would substitute the lumbar kinase.
No, the nattokinase isn't the part of soy that they're allergic to.
It is.
No. It's really not the fermented soys are the only soys that I actually have my people eat in general. Just whether you're allergic to it or not, just soy is a really interesting food at this point. And tofu is the worst form of it. Yeah, the nattokinase, I was gonna say, I don't know, I can't remember exactly. The caps I've been using are from cardiovascular research, and I'm using theirs, and it might be a 20 milligram, and I'm doing about 2 caps TID on that one, 3 times a day, every 8 hours. Was it DVTs that they're having?
Yeah, both of them. And, I mean, it works for any clot. It's clearly, you know, working. But the interesting thing is that it works quite a lot better than the warfarin does, and yet most doctors won't even look at it because it's not prescription.
Right. And then I'm going to talk about warfarin tomorrow a bunch, you know, and vitamin K. And exactly. Absolutely. It's hard to find good research on humans, you know, human data, you know, more long-term studies, you know, outcomes. Yeah, well, there's great clinical, I mean, a lot of us have good clinical experience with it. There's no question about that. Just that a lot of the doctors out there say, well, show me the randomized clinical trial. Where is it? If it's not there, I don't believe you. In oncology, that's the classic answer I get, you know. Well, how can I give this person this? How can I believe in it? You know, there's no proof. So I've just gotten really good at writing long letters and sending tons and tons of research and trying to, you know, have really diplomatic conversations. That's what I do. So.
Just one quick clarification. No issues with bleeding with natto either?
No.
Okay. I had a patient who was concerned that it was causing her nosebleeds, so discontinued it. It was only one.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I've never heard of anybody or had any practitioner, you know, who's been working in our group anywhere that's, you know, has any worry about nattokinase. I've had never even a thought of it. So it's just, you know, it's basically derived from miso. It's such a low dose thing, and this just not going into the, like, you know, what she was saying with warfarin, the mechanism is actually, you know, depleting the uptake of vitamin K is, you know, the body can't clot. This is much different, and you know, as these enzymes are eating up the clots, the body also is recognizing that that's happening, and so the body's maintaining a control. The drugs come in and you say, no, you can't do that anymore. You cannot use vitamin K anymore. And the body's like, whoa, okay, that's one of my main avenues for preventing, you know, bleeding. And so if you can't do that, the body's got to figure out another way to go around it. These just like, you know, they're just not as strong of medicines, but they'll keep eating away at the buildup as it's going on. Okay, I'm going to try to move on from this, but, you know, yes, the research in here is all really good too, and I have lots of research. If you want to, you know, just email me, I can send you stuff too. Phlegm-forming foods. The breakfast of America. Here it is. Bananas, dairy, and it's cold dairy, and it's processed. It's been pasteurized. And then, you know, your good old Frosted Flakes. Nothing like it. So these are like the most phlegm-forming foods. I mean, banana is actually a really phlegm-forming food. And I try to get folks off bananas in general. People love them, but, you know, we're not in the tropics. You know, we're not. It's just not a very good food for us. So I just, you know, everybody's like, oh, but it's fruit. It's good. You know, and it gets my bowels going. And we can do good. We can do a lot of other things. And then dairy, of course, is one of the main phlegm formers. And I heard that in school a lot, and I didn't really, but then, as you know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm not sure about that, you know. And then as you see in practice, you really see some folks have a really big connection with dairy, especially once it's pasteurized, you know. Raw dairy, it's a little different for some people, but there's two different kinds of milk allergies, basically, right? There's casein allergy, which is harder to deal with, the protein, and then there's the sugar allergy, the lactose, lactose intolerance. And either one of those two things is going to be something that you want to definitely have people avoid dairy. And even if they don't have those specific like allergies, it's still a phlegm-forming food. It's just a very mucus kind of generating substance. So I just try to limit it. A lot of folks up in Oregon now are doing goat products. They're doing raw goat milk, and people do better on that. But some folks, I still just, you know, for a while, no dairy at all. No goat milk, no nothing, just to try and clear that up. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm speaking more generally about the population of us who have a blood sugar handling issue, and I don't want them to take it ever. Just pull it for a long time until things calm down. You know, for somebody who's really healthy and they're just in a really great place, I mean, it's not a big deal. You can do bananas. But a lot of folks, I have to just pull the sugar out of their diet, and then I'll pull out the fruit too for a while just because it's so much sugar. But I mean, you know, I think you're thinking of it much more deeply than I probably have. I appreciate that. And I know there's a lot to that. The sugar thing is a big one. Okay, so this is what I was talking about earlier, body fluids, the turbidity, whether that's the heat from like your stagnation, you know, the friction generated, the liver stagnation, the turbidity in the food leads to the dampness, which is that's that fluid that then is not clear anymore, the fluid that doesn't move as smoothly, the fluid that clouds the interaction of the body systems, and then you get phlegm. And phlegm is that more sticky substance. And like I said, it's much more associated with the cholesterol picture. There's a definitely big phlegm to that. Like I said, polycystic ovarian syndrome is a very phlegm-related syndrome. And then phlegm cysts, you know, like I said, like scrofula, goiter are phlegmy cysts. Sometimes nodules in the body, like lipomas and things, are often phlegm-related nodules. One of the kind of Chinese medical sayings is that the phlegm is produced in the spleen and is stored in the lungs. And the spleen is the place where you generate that phlegm. That's that pond. You know, when the pond gets sticky, when it's not working well, that's when you start to get that phlegmy material. But the spleen doesn't keep it there. The spleen stores it in the lungs. That's when people get they get all this phlegm after they eat a meal that's very phlegm-forming, and they've got to cough the phlegm up. They're not coughing it up out of the spleen. They're coughing it up out of the lungs. And it generates a plugged nose, a postnasal drip, all that stuff through the sinuses, which are the sensory orifice of the lung. So people get that phlegmy response in the lungs after eating a phlegm rich food, or in some people, it's just a constant process of just always having phlegm, and then it starts to plug the ears too, because the whole eustachian canal connects the ears into the otopharynx, and this whole system is related into the lungs, and we've got phlegm in there. This phlegm is constantly moving up through that system, and you're trying to get it out, but it's that plugging. Another thing that happens is phlegm misting the heart, and I think that phlegm misting the heart or phlegm clouding the heart is another form of depression or mania as well, where there's the phlegm actually is making the Shen, which is the spiritual aspect of the heart, like your emperor, it's starting to make that a lack of clarity there. So you're not even sure anymore about what your true voice is inside of you. You're kind of losing that because the phlegm is misting. It's creating a cloudiness inside of your spirit. And that's really a big deal. That's really important. So that we use certain herbs that are very phlegm resolving. They open the orifices and clear phlegm. Those things are really important in these kind of people. And that's one kind of depression also you can have. And phlegm can be very, very depressing to the system. It can really slow things down and make people feel really bogged and their memory gets slowed and foggy headedness. Phlegm is a big factor there, blocking the channels and collaterals. There's, you know, people have done long talks on different kinds of phlegm. There's invisible phlegm and there's visible phlegm. The invisible phlegm is kind of in the pathways, in the channels of the body. You don't see it necessarily. The visible phlegm is more the stuff you can actually cough up and spit it out. It might be in a nodule somewhere. So phlegm masses, these are the things I talked about. Lipomas are really interesting. And I don't know if you've ever tried to treat lipomas, but there's something really deep and spiritual. David, you know, what is the Cherokee way of thinking about lipomas? I'd be curious. Would you have a little thought on that? Because there's definitely a spiritual side of it. You know, there's something magical or something about them. I don't know what it is. It's like something beyond the normal. You know, because I can't. I mean, there's definitely a liver possibility. The liver's not doing its job of getting rid of stuff, so you pack away this material. But they come up in these really strange places, and I don't know. I don't know. It's a hard one to treat too.
Yeah, I mean, I have some treatments that use a cake for a very
long time.
Sort of energetic system, not quite as defined as TCM.
but it's primarily seen as just a sort of a cold, damp manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not anything attributed to it per se.
Yeah, I think there's something like psychosomatic with them too, though, and I'm not sure what it is, but they come up in strange places on people in different times, and I always wonder what's the kind of deeper working of it. Obviously, there's a deep emotional, spiritual side of things, and the liver not being able to clear some kind of energy, oftentimes I see that as some kind of expression in the skin. A lot of times I'll see people with toxic liver have, you know, outbreaks on the skin, on the surface of the skin, and lipomas is like a fatty material, and that fatty material isn't being digested and absorbed. So on the emotional level, the fat of the body is the hard stuff to break down, right? Like, you know, someone dies in your family or you go through a divorce or whatever, it's real hard to emulsify that big of an experience into small enough pieces that you can actually chew it, get through it, and get rid of it, you know? And I think that with the body, something happens in that way. You can't get through that experience and you just don't know where to put it, so the body just puts it in the skin somewhere and you get this lump of this gooey material. It's really interesting. I'm not sure. I haven't figured out exactly what the best way to treat them are. Some of them respond to acupuncture deeply. You go all the way around the lipoma surrounding the dragon, do electro underneath it. That can sometimes reduce them. But most of the time, people have them drained, is what I find, if they don't like them, if they're unsightly. Robert?
In terms of phlegm, is agave considered a sweet?
Agave... Okay, that's really a good question because unfortunately, you know, we were just out in the desert. You see the agave plant, you know, and it's this beautiful desert plant, right? And you think about where does the syrup come from? You know, you don't tap the agave plant and get agave syrup. It just doesn't happen. So when you do the research and find out how they make agave syrup, you take 6 chemical steps to go from an agave plant to agave syrup. So you have a 6-step conversion, and it's basically 70% high fructose when it comes out in the end. High fructose corn syrup is 55% high fructose. So somebody is making a lot of money on organic blue agave syrup, and unfortunately, it's one of the worst sweeteners out there. The sweeteners I want people to do are stevia, Lohan, xylitol, and then molasses, and then maybe some little bits of honey if they don't have a big problem with it, or you know, maple syrup, that kind of stuff. But generally, not a lot of, you know, Tim Francis always says, people, you got to remember, honey is a really great medicine, but it's a terrible food. And he's absolutely right, you know. Little bits. And of course, honey raw and unheated only, right? So another thing about this is the phlegm and blood stagnation combined together. And one of the main places we see that is rheumatoid arthritis. And you get the pannus, right, where the actual synoviocytes are overproducing. There's this little autoimmunity. And to me, autoimmunity is always a lack of clarity in the immune system. We talk about immune disruption, and so it's the lack of clarity is this failure of the body to identify clearly what is self versus non-self. And when the body can't determine what's self versus non-self, how do you know what's you and what's not you? You can't. How do you figure it out? So it doesn't really happen, right? So when an area is real cloudy and phlegmy, you take the example of the thyroid, right? So the thyroid gland, and this is interesting because gluten is, you know, as a sensitive food for a lot of people, is very influential on the thyroid gland. When people have a sensitivity to gluten and they have a thyroid problem, with they have elevated thyroid peroxidase antibodies and they have a hypothyroid state, I always have them go off of gluten completely. The reason being that the gluten is basically becoming an antigen, okay? And that antigen has now got memory B cells that have formed an antibody towards that antigen, okay? So the immune system, the humoral immune system, has said, hey, every time that thing comes, we need to get rid of it. We're going to stick an antibody on that thing. It's going to form an antigen-antibody complex. Then that thing circulates in the bloodstream until it sticks somewhere, until a macrophage or dendritic cell comes along, grabs it, and then presents it back to the immune system, says, this is what it is. They said, yeah, that's cool. We got that. We'll make some more antibodies. So the antibodies go out there. It's that process of that sticking together of the antigen-antibody complex into the tissue. And in the thyroid, it's running real fast. And you've got this heat that's already happening there. So the tissue's already, you know, a little bit sensitive because you've got to use a lot of glutathione to cool that off. You've got to cool that system, quench that system down. Gluten, as it's going in the body, is creating more heat. More heat is being generated. The thyroid really generates it quickly. And if you don't get rid of that insult, the body starts to have this situation where that antigen-antibody complex gets taken apart in the presence of its own living cells and tissue. And those pieces of living cells and tissue get broken apart into the bloodstream. All kinds of bits of the cytosol, ribosomes, and parts of the nucleus, and they're all exposed into the bloodstream. And it's all together in one big mess. And if you're real phlegmy and real turbid, and there's really not a clear thing going on there, vitamin D levels are low, all that kind of stuff, man, the body's like, well, darn it, I just grabbed a hold of something, and I don't know what it is, and I'm going to show it, and the body says, oh, that's definitely not me. But it is you. And now you have an antibody towards that part of your body. And the body kicks that piece, those antibodies out, and they stick to that little part of your thyroid gland every time. And then your body has to take apart itself. And then that's when you're into this autoimmune flare and you're eating yourself away. And it's very hot, it's very dangerous, it's very inflammatory, and that's when things can get out of control. So we lose that mechanism of control in there. It's also a big part of the cancer process. But phlegm and blood stagnation together, that's one of those manifestations where the synovial slides overproduce and overproduce and overproduce, and they make this thick layer of this thing called a pannus, and the joint gets real thick, and then the fingers get deformed. At first, it's just painful. That's blood stagnation. And then after a while, the phlegm gets involved, and that's where you get the deformity, these big lumps, and the fingers look terrible. That's phlegm and blood stagnation. So we treat that with herbs that are very specific for breaking up the blood stagnation and resolving the phlegm. And there's all, you know, lots of traditional formulas. It's a type of what is called the pain syndrome, B syndrome. And then if the person has a hot one that, you know, responds really well to cold, you change your formula. Or if a person has a cold one that responds to heat, then you change your formula for that. You always go with the hot or the cold nature. Lymphedema is also a phlegm and blood stagnation. Also, you know, lymphedema is the process that happens after you've removed the lymph nodes, you know, during a surgical procedure, and then you're left with all that scar tissue. And also the lymph system now has to redirect itself to try and drain all the toxins from the tissues downstream to get back to the lymph nodes and to the thoracic ducts. That doesn't happen very well when you've taken out 9 lymph nodes in the axilla or in the inguinal region, and you get this lymphedema where the limb swells. It's very hard to treat, but I'll tell you, bromelain, high doses of bromelain with lots of ginkgo. I've got a whole, like, you know, lots of, you know, stone root and what's the other one I'm thinking of? Centella. There's a centellin extract. There's a specific extract called centellin of Asiaticosides from centella, from ginkgo, and Gota Cola. Those are all really good. There's a whole procedure I do for getting rid of lymphedema and breaking up, but then you use herbs that reduce phlegm. In Chinese medicine, lymphedema is a big phlegm thing. So pinellia and the citrus peel, those aromatic herbs we talked about that smell real nice, those will help to break up that phlegm and get blood and lymph flowing. Phytolacca. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually, I was just thinking that the colensonia I threw in there, but the horse chestnut's another one that I really like in that one. Okay. Some tumors are more phlegmy than others. That's another thing. It's kind of cool to be able to identify what are they made of. Part of the phlegm picture here, we got cholesterol imbalances, elevated insulin and insulin-like growth factors, okay, and then adipocytes, adipocyte hormones. So what are the adipocytes? They're the fat cells, right? The fat cells are making these hormones, and the three main ones that we have right now, and there's like 9 maybe that are identified now, they keep increasing, but the main one, resistin, is produced by the adipocytes, and it resists the communication between insulin and glucose. So it helps the body maintain higher levels of insulin and glucose. So when you have the fat-making machinery, it's really hard to burn fat. Because the body wants to keep storing it and keep that system in place. It's very hard to overcome. And leptin is another one. You can run leptin levels in people's bodies, and you'll see that most people with a lot of obesity, especially if they're very, you know, sedentary and don't have a good diet, their leptin levels are high. That stuff just disrupts that whole metabolic process. And it's very hard to get anything done in that person as far as weight loss, you know, that kind of stuff, metabolic increase, without getting that leptin level down. And there's nothing that I know of that directly will lower that level other than just lots of exercise, reducing your caloric intake, just eating a really good diet. You know, and sometimes people saying that brown seaweed, there's some of that idea of the different seaweeds that could possibly help. Iodine can be a little bit of a factor. But then adiponectin is another one of those hormones that's actually associated with decreased insulin resistance. And so that level declines, actually, as people get more into metabolic syndrome. Cholesterol imbalances and the low-density lipids being high, triglycerides being high, and triglycerides often is, you know, people are just doing something wrong, pretty much, like, you know, sodas, you know, nicotine, too much alcohol, chips, you know, you can normally find something that they're doing that's elevating those. Of course, there's a lot more to the cholesterol picture now as we get into lipoprotein little a and lipoprotein big A and lipoprotein B and ApoE4, all the genetics you can look at to find out if that person is really predisposed to a certain kind of lipid picture. And that'll go back to that idea we had before of look at your bloodline and what kind of foods did your parents eat and what kind of foods did your great-great-great parents eat and how was the health, and then you can determine something about what you should and shouldn't do. You know, some people just have to avoid more fats than other people. Most of the time I like people to eat fats. Remember, saturated fats are great for us. They're awesome. Coconut oil. Butter, animal fats if they're not overcooked. just stretching. Okay. Here's a formula for phlegm, the two-cure decoction. Just a basic example, pinellia and citrus peel with the poriococcus and a little bit of licorice. And that's a really nice, simple formula, long-term, for resolving phlegm. One of the adages in Chinese medicine talks about how it is to get rid of phlegm in the body, and they use the idea that it's like taking oil and flour, mixing them together, and then separating them again. So once you've mixed oil and flour, how do you get them apart? So it's a very slow process. They also use the adage that getting rid of phlegm is sort of like taking a silkworm cocoon and unraveling it from one thread and pulling that thread until you've unraveled the whole silkworm cocoon. So it takes a long time. So when you're doing the phlegm stuff with people, you've got to get the diet and lifestyle stuff straight, and then you've got to also use these therapeutics, and they need to work over time. They're going to be slow over a long time, but people will start to feel better in a hurry. Drying dampness, transforming phlegm, regulating qi. This stuff's all just kind of for your notes. The D long is in here, the earthworm. And then also this Bing Pian, borneol, which comes from camphor-containing plants that they've extracted from for opening the orifice. It's very aromatic. It's a great one for topicals to open the surface of the body to get things deeper. I think it's kind of like, it works kind of like DMSO in that way a little bit. And then the Shichang Pu, the Rhizoma acorus. This is a really good one if you can get the whole plant. We use it as a granule, but it's not very potent. I don't know. People probably have it in a tincture, too. I don't use it in a tincture, but the whole herb works very nicely. Great for people when they get their head plugged, get that head-plugging feeling with too much phlegm up here. Other thing I use is something called candibactin. You guys know candibactin? It's like a thyme, oregano, and sage oils, essential oils. It's a real nice way to go, just to open up the orifices of the head if there's a lot of phlegm up there. Those are all kind of symptomatic, though. So the deeper stuff is the diet and, you know, changing the internal constitution. No. Heat? Absolutely. Yeah, one of the guys I studied with in China was really cool. Is Dr. Xie, who was a gastroenterologist, master doctor, and he was always saying that, you know, there's two ways to get rid of the dampness. One way is you warm it, and the other way is, like, the idea is that you take your clothes, you did your laundry, and now you're going to put them out to dry, and it's a day without any sunlight. Well, the breeze is what dries the clothes. So you have the wind going across it. So that's the aromatic herbs. And they don't have to be warm. They can be neutral. A lot of these herbs are not hot in nature. Too cured. Pinellia is a little bit warm. Citrus is pretty, very little warm, mostly neutral. So let me go back here and see. These guys right here, this is the Gualo is a cooling herb. Chuanbeimu is cooling herb. Jiegeng is neutral. Banxia is slightly warm. And Chenpi is slightly warm, maybe neutral. So they're both sides. And there's two different classes of herbs. There's one that's herbs that resolve cold phlegm, and there's herbs that resolve warm phlegm. So there's actually two whole sides of that picture in Chinese medicine. So here's my little essence, glutathione and oxidative fire. Are you guys all familiar with glutathione, the concept of people in here? Anybody not know what that is? You guys all know glutathione? You got some idea what that is? Cool. Good. So it's a very sulfur-rich compound, right, that our body uses to quench free radicals. That's our main way of quenching that fire that's getting out of control all the time. And so this picture to me is kind of nice because you've got the ocean there that's kind of like our deep reserve of our essence back to the kidney, and the essence is generating that glutathione. It's one of the things we're making out of the essence is this glutathione, which is then quenching that fire. So I loved this picture. It really did make me feel like this is what's happening in the body and in the thyroid gland especially. Key factors in mortality and morbidity, aging, a big part, we talked about cataracts and eye diseases, we talked about cardiovascular disease, neurological disorders, dementia and Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, neurofibrous tangles and beta amyloid deposits and the inflammation in the brain. How do we reduce that from happening? Well, essence nourishing herbs are going to build glutathione by building the essence. And now we're studying them and finding that they all have little enzymes in them that actually generate glutathione. Well, the thing is also is that we're all having this depleted diet. We're not getting a good diet. And what's going on with that is that we don't have the precursors to build glutathione. It's made up of three amino acids. Anybody know what they are? The three amino acids that make up glutathione? I think Steve does. Cysteine. Glycine, right, exactly. Okay, so those are the three amino acids. Those are the building blocks of glutathione. So you've got to have those three going in, right? We need to have that in the source. What's a good source of cysteine? We've got a good source of cysteine. I mean, egg yolks are a great source. Whey protein. Exactly. And glutamine, Glutamine actually is coming from the wheat berry most of the time, but there's a process of getting it. It's in a lot of foods. And then glycine is another one. That's an amino acid that's in a lot of foods, meats and vegetables and things. So just eat a good diet and you'll get a lot of these precursors, but you need to have them present. Selenium is a good recycling agent for glutathione. And then you have alpha-lipoic acid, which is an indirect antioxidant, which recycles the antioxidant capacity of glutathione. So those are sort of some of the five basic things I do just to kind of keep the system working. Then the herbs that we have generate through an enzyme the signal to rebuild glutathione. So you're kind of rebuilding it all the time. So you've got to have all that stuff working. For people that have a lot of oxidative damage occurring, they've got to find a way to quench that, and they've got to keep that stuff under control. And a big part of it is don't put the insults in your body. And another part of it is eat the right foods. And then for some people who have chronic disease, they need help. They need herbs. They need nutrition. Okay? And that's where we can come in and help them. So the damp heat terrain. We talked about damp heat. There's a little bacterial infection for you. Endocrine disruption can lead to damp heat. And you guys kind of get the idea of damp heat. So we talked about dampness a lot, right? That's like gummy, clear, unclear, thick stuff. And then heat, of course, is like heat. I mean, your heart rate's faster. You've got elevated blood pressure, redness in the face. You feel excited, anxious, the red skin, itchiness. All that stuff is part of heat. You guys follow that? So a damp heat condition is the dampness part, that cloudiness, that lack of clarity, all that, you know, and the phlegmy part of things combined with the heat. That's a nasty combination. So when bacterial infections get going, you see that, you know, especially look at lesions, the staph lesions and strep lesions and things, when it goes septic, that's a damp heat in the blood system. It's, you know, it really gets to be pretty severe. Damp heat in the liver is something we see quite often. Alcohol really directly hits the liver and creates damp heat in the liver. Over time, you'll see damp heat in the liver. Toxic substances, that's the alcohol, toxic emotions. So not being able to process the life experience, like I said, through the liver, right? If it's too big, you can't emulsify it. You don't have the bile capacity to emulsify the emotional experience that you're having. Then you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a big chunk of something that you can't digest. You've got to do something with it. Oftentimes that leads to some sort of an ecological change. Allergies and sensitivities can lead to damp heat. You know, you can see people get that real hot kind of face thing. Most of the time with allergies, there's a wind component. Wind isn't something we haven't talked about, but it's part of the Chinese medicine pathological influences, but it combines with the dampness or the heat, and you can have wind damp or wind heat conditions. Wind is mostly itchy and ticks and tremors and things. Autoimmunity can also have a damp heat capacity. Like you look at psoriatic lesions oftentimes have a very damp heat look. But then again, they also could have a blood stagnation look. They could also have more of a deficiency kind of picture. One thing I was thinking about, you know, the germ theory, you know, going back to that, and the Chinese didn't look at the germs. They didn't say, oh, there's these microorganisms that we're trying to kill. That's not what they were doing. They identified the pathogenic influences as ecological change, and they said, okay, well, we need to change the ecosystem. So we've got to find a cold herb that's bitter that will drain heat out of a person that's got a hot condition. Well, that's pretty cool. So when I think about these bugs that do inhabit an area, like if your body gets damaged, and you know, we're talking about the gut flora and this incredible balance that we have that to share life with all these other organisms, if we get out of balance, a certain organism finds an opportunistic moment and takes over, and it starts growing and proliferating in our body because it was already an environment that supported its growth. Same thing with cancer. Cancer will capitalize on the opportunity that we provide for it. So if you're already giving yourself a situation where you have a lot of dampness, a lot of phlegm, a lot of damp heat, you're inviting the change because something else is going to find that an opportunity to survive. And so if you can go ahead and, you know, you don't have to think about it as these kind of germs. You can also think about it as just like, let's get rid of the environmental conditions that support that bug living in my body. If you do that, then that bug will no longer be able to survive. And I mean, the thing is, you can't eradicate the body of bugs. We have trillions of them in us right now. But we want to find them in balance. So changing the ecosystem in the body is the approach that I like to use, whether it comes to the strep or staph infection, you know, whatever it might be. Of course, like David said, if you've got a really acute bacterial meningitis, well, let's get you some serious treatment in a hurry. And that's not herbs. That's going to be, you know, an IV antibiotic. I did just have a guy come back with a MRSA infection from India who had done 10 courses of antibiotics while he was there for 13 months. Came in, he was a super depleted, you know, 20-year-old guy, so full of life, but just like kind of depressed and down and just not doing well. And his dad's a nurse, so he said, you know, we need to get you more antibiotics. And I'm like, no, no more antibiotics. I gave him one more course of Bactrim. He felt terrible. Next, you know, within a week, he had more lesions coming out. They tested it again. It's MRSA. So I said, okay, I said, just give me this guy for, I want him for 6 weeks. So 6 weeks, I did, you know, a whole protocol with him. It's been 3 months. He has no more infection. Totally, but I used Dongui Bushuitong, that formula I told you about, astragalus with angelica. I gave him, 95 milligrams or 95 grams of raw astragalus a day, you know, with the 23 grams of angelica a day. I did that every day for 2 weeks. I did a huge dose. We did lots of probiotics. We did lots of herbs. Did the whole bunch of lymphagogues. Did poke and, you know, echinacea and ceanothus and, you know, that whole side of things. Lots of propolis. Did a coursing a week, you know, 1 week on, 1 week off. High doses of vitamin A. And, man, you know, lots of colloidal silver. High doses of high potency colloidal silver. But really cool protocol I can give you guys. But that was really amazing. Just knock that out. And his dad was kind of like, whoa, something to this thing. You know, he's like one of the head nurses at the hospital. So it's good to see that he allowed me to. What's that? I know, exactly. Inflammation's an interesting concept, right? There's hot inflammation and cold inflammation, which is kind of funny because someone could have inflammation in their body. It doesn't mean that they're hot. It doesn't mean that they have a hot condition. It normally is associated because most of the time we find that it is. And the whole world in inflammation has this idea that it's this fire, it's flaming, you know. But it's not necessarily. People who could have a cold condition and still have inflammation, you know, a rampant cellular condition. So some objective findings, blood pressure elevation, rapid heart rate, elevated body temperature. These are all damp heat manifestations. Look at the, you know, C-reactive protein elevations, the sedimentation rate, homocysteine. There's a lot more to this picture, but these are the main ones I like to take a look at if I'm going to see someone with inflammation. Yeah?
So how does the CRP relate to what you talked about with cold inflammation?
It's hard to say, Robert. I'm not sure. But if somebody has a joint that's inflamed or a joint that have pain in the joint, okay. What kind of cancer?
At this point, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Does it matter the type of cancer? What if their CRP is up? And how do you know? Does it matter whether it's a hot or cold
inflammation? Well, you got to find out if the person's having heat symptoms or cold symptoms. You know, that's the thing. And sometimes it's the cancer might be real fast growing, really rapid and really hot and generating a lot of heat, or it might not be. It might be the person might actually have a cold constitution. They might actually be cold. They might feel deficient. They might be really weak. In that case, you still need to give them warming herbs, you know, to rebuild them. The inflammation process is still inflammation. I'm just saying you can't just say if someone has inflammation, you're going to cool them down. You know, it's not always that way. Like for some people who have like a pain somewhere, they have a cancer, that person might need a warming therapy. I mean, turmeric is like people just throw it out to people, but it's actually a warming herb. You know, it's actually, you know, if someone has a warm condition, giving them a lot of turmeric might not be the best approach. I'd rather have them find out if they have a warm or cold condition, and then if it's cold, give them more turmeric.
Does nature fast food a lot of homeopathy? So sometimes
right.
I mean, it sounds to me like you do with Chinese medicine is opposite cures.
To some degree, yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, most of the time you want to balance things to some degree, you know, but depending if you can really clearly say that this person has, you know, a really cold, if their condition is cold, like meaning that they actually have cold hands and feet, a cold body temperature, maybe they've got a reduced heart rate, you know, those kind of things, you know, low blood pressure, then that person needs to get some yang energy, they need to get warmed up, you kind of, you know, get them warm. They might also have a process going on, though, that's an inflammatory process at that same time, you know. I think that most autoimmunity is hot. You know, most autoimmunity is hot, but I don't always just decide that if they have an autoimmune disease, I'm going to treat them with cold herbs. That's just not, I want to look at their constitution and find out what's going on and then treat them with appropriate therapy. It's just got to be on the basis of the constitution of the person. Hard to answer your question, Robert. It's a good question, though. And the CRP is not always super reliable. You know, it's hard one to correlate all the time. It's a C-reactive protein, cardiac reactive protein. But it is a good indicator, especially in disease progression and a lot of these conditions, whether it's autoimmune or cancer. Good one to look at. So some herbs that clear heat and dry dampness. Those the top three, Huang Qin, Huang Liang, Huang Bai, those are all berberine-rich compounds that are all really cold and bitter in nature. Bitter is known to clear fire. It drains fire from the body. Cold, of course, is the opposite of hot, so it has that heat-clearing effect. The Huang Qin is more lung-oriented, upper body and liver. The Huang Liang, the coptis, is more for the digestive system. And the Huang Bai, the philodendron, is more for the genitourinary tract. Yes?
Those top three are great
absolutely. Perfect. Yep. And then the Long Don Sao is actually the dragon gallbladder herb. That's another one that's really great for liver too. That's another one that clears heat. And that one's really good for the kind of genital herpes outbreaks. It's a really good one for that area because the liver channel circles the testes in Chinese medicine. So that herb specifically clears heat from the liver channel. And then I'll just kind of put some comparisons up there. You know, we talked about how do you bridge between Western herbs and Chinese ideas, and sort of, you know, Oregon grapefruit and golden seal, both are very rich in berberine also and have similar, you know, applications. Yeah.
Do those come in a specific formula?
There is a formula, and it's right here. Huangmian Jade Tong, Coptis decoction to relieve toxicity. You can get that in a tea pill. I'll go back to that. We'll get to that in just a minute here. Okay, we got through that. Good. Antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, anti-neoplastic. But here's the thing. I mean, again, the concept in the biomedical model is let's kill the bug. We found the bug, let's kill it. And most of the time, it's a mechanism. We're going to find a mechanism, and we're going to use our knowledge, our clever ideas. We're going to apply one specific molecule, like a beta-lactam antibiotic, to, you know, a gram-positive bacteria, and we're going to see that it inhibits that bacteria from being able to reproduce, and the bacteria breaks and down and dies. Well, what happens? We're affecting one specific pathway, and that always results in a huge mutational challenge. The mutational challenge induces mutation, and then you get resistant strains. We're just generating, you know, resistant strains left and right all the time. I mean, one of my favorite compounds in the world, artemisinin, which comes from Artemisia annua, that plant was the cure for malaria. And it was amazing. And then in Cambodia, on the borders of Cambodia and Thailand, they've been using artemisinin, one isolated compound from that plant, and they decided to use it as a pharmaceutical-grade extract alone. And they gave it to people, and now there are artemisinin-resistant strains of bacteria. Or, I mean, what are they talking about? Yes. Thank you. Toxoplasmas. Yes, exactly. So just saying that, you know, this approach is, these are multitasking plants that have many, many compounds in them that are doing, you know, they're helping the body do the job of identifying the invader, getting rid of it by changing the environment. So that's the concept. This is just one exemplary plant, Huang Qin, Scutellaria. Fantastic plants. Plant here that clears damp heat. It's in that category of herbs that clears damp heat. So it clears heat, dries the dampness, disperses fire, gets rid of toxins, stops bleeding, and prevents miscarriage. This is actually a very safe plant during pregnancy. You know, the thing with, that's funny, one of the questions I always would get, I did a lot of, 6 years I did of medical consulting work for a company called Natura Health Products. And every Thursday I'd get, you know, maybe between 6 and 10 doctors would call me and say, I got a question about this thing, I got a question about this person. So I would just answer their questions. And a question that would come up a lot was, I've got a pregnant patient. Can I give her this herb? And my thing is, you know, it's pregnant people are not—they're not all equal. Whether or not you're pregnant isn't the big thing. What's going on with that person? Did they have 6 miscarriages before or now? Are they totally pale and depleted, and their tongue is puffy, and they feel terrible, or are they super strong and they've had 3 natural home births? You know, what are we dealing with here? You know, as far as that goes, you don't just, you know, just pick a person out and say this herb is good for pregnancy, this herb is not good for pregnancy. You know, it doesn't work that way. Each person is totally unique, and most herbs are safe in pregnancy. The caution in Chinese medicine is if it's an herb that invigorates the blood and promotes blood circulation, you want to be cautious with it. And then some herbs have high toxicities, and you don't want to use them. But it's really a small portion of the whole materia medica. So just like with anything, you've got to really think about what is the patient presenting with and how is their constitution going to react to the treatment. It's big. You guys get that, the pregnancy thing? Yeah, people get that question a lot. Can I take this when I'm pregnant? It's a great question. Here's just some idea of the research that I'm into with the group that I'm with. Just tons of great research on this herb and its anti-inflammatory activities, antipyretic, cholagogic, antimicrobial, on and on it goes. Main compounds will go in bicolin, and then one other one called oridonin. All those have been sort of isolated and then tested for their anti-cancer properties, very strong. But, you know, again, I really like the whole plants. And like we'll be talking about tonight, my part of the panel will be talking about combining extracts with whole herbs. I always want the whole herb because the whole herb is the directing force. It's kind of like the symphony that was created by the creator. And that's the thing that we're asking for the help from. And we're going to try and say, okay, this person's got a really serious condition. We want to get a little bit more specific with it. We're going to add some more of a part of that plant. And then the guidance is still there. That's the concept. rather than just getting high doses of nutraceuticals and giving them in huge doses. Because once again, it's like giving someone a bunch of DHEA, for example. Like people are always like, oh, you give them DHEA? I don't normally give people DHEA. I don't want to give them the precursor hormone that can become anything, because if you look at the breakdown of hormones, the body, if the enzyme systems aren't functioning properly, then you can create any outcome you could imagine as far as the hormone pathways go. If you're 17 keto metabolites of estrogen that are very proliferative to cancers, if you just dump DHEA into a person who has an enzyme system that's making that, well, you're not just giving them DHEA, you're giving them that. That's just how it goes. Unless you're gonna get in there and change the enzyme pathways and make sure that they're working appropriately, and you can do urine tests, you can do 2 to 16 high, estrogen ratios, you can look at their urinary output of methylation byproducts, so forth. Or you can just look at the person, see what they're, see how they are, how their presentation is, and just try to avoid giving them hormones if we can get their body to function in a way that's more in harmony with, their health and well-being. Most people in here, you guys, most of you are into HRT or not? You do it? You prescribe it? Do you have any kind of a discerning kind of parameter for who you give it to or who you won't?
Oh, I'm very thorough into practical history and personal habits. And you have to have a good conversation with them on an ongoing basis. And so they trust you and you trust them. But I always tell them that if you take it and do nothing to change your lifestyle, you're not giving them hormones directions, and they're going to make you fat, they're going to make you sick, they're going to cause problems. So you're just going to grow your problems unless you change the cause of your problems, which is not the hormone deficiency. They can help or they can hurt, but then you just have to work with your patient as best you can.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, but
I don't like the synthetics. They cause a lot. And oral estrogens are horrible.
So you do the bioidenticals?
Yeah, but I really try to avoid the oral ones, even if they're bioidentical, because the liver stuff, mm-hmm. and the aromatase, and the insulin stuff.
Mm-hmm. All that stuff. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I try to avoid hormones in general. I mean, what's funny is that, every patient that's come to me with breast cancer who was on hormones was immediately pulled off of them as soon as her cancer was identified. That's kind of interesting to me, considering that most people agree that it takes about 10 years for a breast cancer to develop. So if a person's taking hormones that are running down a faulty enzyme pathway that's generating a hormone metabolite that's pushing the growth of that breast cancer early on, and control is slowly being lost, we don't know that, So that's where I'm really cautious about it, because I've seen a lot of breast cancer patients, a lot of cancer patients, and I would say that the majority of them have some history of either birth control or HRT. And if not, then it's, we've got plastics and lots of estrogen mimics, xenoestrogens in our environment too. Just caution. I just think caution is a good thing with all that.
Support the liver.
Always. Phosphorylation. Hey, there's a match being lit. So phosphorylation, cool stuff, right? So there's all these, kinases, these activating enzymes in the cells, and the phosphorus is a really important part of igniting the cell functions to happen. And so a lot of these pathways that we study in cancer and other diseases and how we want to influence them is through this pathway called phosphorylation. This little phrase, the cost of doing business in an oxygen-rich environment, that's what we've been hitting on kind of all day today. We're running fuel. We're basically burning fuel in oxygen, which is just like having a fire in your house. And if you have a fire and your chimney's really, plugged up, there's a lot of soot in there, there's not good airflow, then there's smoke in the house and the thing is getting stuck and it's just the fire doesn't go very well. That's what's happening in a lot of people's bodies right now. You can have a different kind of system running where your fire is running real hot and every piece of wood you put in there burns into ash and there's nothing in that chimney. It just all gets burned up really fine. It's very efficient. And I'm always trying to push for that kind of a cost, the cost that's very low. And then having the idea that there's always going to be some cost, there's going to be some extra heat, some off-gassing, and that's got to be quenched. We've got to deal with that. And that's where the glutathione stuff comes in. So heat toxins, the fourth one of these things, the last one, infection, raging cellular processes, and loss of control. It's kind of what we're talking about with these deeper diseases. We're talking about autoimmunity especially. Heat toxins often get released through the skin. So people will have these, a really big outbreaks. Also, like the throat is a really good place to see heat toxins. An early onset of a really severe bacterial infection, a flu or something, you can get a lot of, throat toxins. You'll see the ulcers form on there. Heat toxins coming out of the body and ulcerations on the top, pus, abscesses, and sores. byproducts of cancer metabolism. You know, lactic acid is a good one, good example, and the ketones that are generated. And that's like, you know, really gets into the body and creates this toxic waste that the body has to deal with constantly. And one thing that's interesting, you know, people got into this idea that, you know, one group of, or one line of thought is that, you know, there's this thing called metabolic acidosis, right? Which is that there's a tax over time of having too much acidic intake in your diet, in your life. And so you need to, you know, counter that with using a lot of alkaline substances. And so people are doing potassium or calcium or magnesium in, you know, carbonate forms or whatever to try and reduce that sort of lactic acid rich, you know, acidic kind of environment. The problem is, you know, that I like that concept to some degree, but I think you just need to switch your diet. I don't think you need to do that. I'd rather have you just eat more greens and, you know, eat foods that are just a little bit more kind of cooling. But some cancers are very rich in lactic acid. They produce a lot of it. And so there's a marker called LDH, lactic acid dehydrogenase, and you can see that in the bloodstream. And it can often be correlated with tumor progression because the cancer, in its very inefficient burning of sugar in the presence of oxygen or not oxygen, is creating this byproduct, and it's lactic acid. So you can see that in the blood. Robert?
So if you have a patient who's overweight with cancer, you know, damp feet and stuff, where do you go as far as weight loss while they're getting there, while you're supporting them and they may be doing chemotherapy or something like that? A lot of people don't think they should be losing any weight during their therapy program.
They don't think they should be?
Should be. This is what I hear.
That they should, that that's not, it's not good for them. Well, that's kind of a long conversation. I'd be glad to have it with you, though, at another time. Let's keep moving on through this stuff. I think that's a good question. But I mean, obviously, cachexia is one of the biggest killers in the cancer, you know, treatment model, and especially in pancreatic cancer. That's what people die of. And that's why they're dying so fast, especially after Whipple surgery, where they take out your whole digestive system. Very hard to recover from that. But anyway, I was going to say, so then the interesting thing is that in the blood, the pH of the blood is regulated to 0.02 of a point. So you're never going to switch the blood pH beyond, you know, 7.38 is about all you're going to get. You know, it's going to be real tightly controlled. So dumping a bunch of sodium carbonate and potassium carbonate in your body, it just creates a high buffer, and you're going to urinate that out. You're not actually going to change your blood pH. That's an interesting, you know, thing with this whole Simoncini thing about giving people lots of sodium bicarbonate to try and, you know, reduce their cancer. Well, what I have people do is that some cancers are very glycolytic. They produce a lot of lactic acid. Some of them aren't. And if people really are into this theory, have them take some sodium bicarbonate. If they feel better, well, then they can do it. It's okay. Mix it in water and take some. It probably is helping get some of that lactic acid out of their system. But it might make them feel really sick, and then don't do it.
Don't most cancers, if not all, they don't have mitochondria, so they have this glycolysis.
They're using an aerobic glycolysis now. And what they're doing is they're recruiting fibroblasts who do have mitochondria, who are then recycling the fuel to the cancer. And it's this really weird interplay. It's called the reverse Warburg effect. And it's like we're just at the tip of the iceberg of this whole thing, really. You know, yeah, but it's really interesting. Wind heat invasion, soreness and swelling of the throat, that was the heat toxins. And then light herbs that I love, the Lonicera, that's our local honeysuckle here. Forsythia, that's another plant that grows up in Oregon all over the place in my backyard. We've got dandelion there, Herba taraxacum, a number of other herbs here. I love the Andrographis, an incredible herb, anti-neoplastic, very cold and bitter, the king of the bitters in Chinese herbs. Very hard to take just as a standard oral, but it's a wonderful herb for cooling down. And the andrographolides in there are wonderful anti-inflammatories. Isatis is a plant that I really love, and this is the indigo extracted from the isatis. Really powerful in leukemias, in deep, what's called heat in the blood as well. And then tea also, lucha, which is a cooling botanical that also reduces the toxins. I'm going to talk about green tea tomorrow. I love green tea. It's phenomenal. This is a formula with a lot of those herbs in it called Wu Wei Xiao Du Yin, 5-ingredient decoction to eliminate toxins. And there's some actions of those herbs. I'm not going to go into that in more detail. A little bit about the Polygonum cuspidatum, the knotweed. This particular herb resolves phlegm, resolves blood stagnation, and clears heat toxins. Wonderful herb to do all those things. Really powerful. So people were super interested in this plant because of that, and they found that it had the resveratrol in it. And resveratrol is the stuff in the grapeseed and skin. That's the, you know, the big anti-aging thing, the French paradox, all of that. And so resveratrol has all these other benefits. But look at this, you know, toxins, phlegm, moving the blood, clearing heat, and draining dampness. It's a great, great herb for my whole talk. Like this herb, I love this herb, the Japanese knotweed. some biomedical actions of resveratrol, particularly a direct antioxidant, so it's actually scavenging free radicals. It supports both estrogen production in a normal way, and it's anti-estrogenic in places where estrogen has become a negative factor, like in an estrogen-positive breast cancer. Cancer prevention through lots of different mechanisms, anti-HIV, and it's got to be the trans resveratrol is the only form you can get if you're going to get it as a nutraceutical. And it comes in different concentrations now from some certain companies. Make sure that it's, if you're going to use it, that it's extracted properly, and we'll save that for later. And then enhancing effectiveness of Taxol. That's one of, you know, major cancer therapy, big one in prostate cancer, but more so in breast cancer. And this compound, here's just a little example. It's a stilbean. Stilbeans are compounds made by plants to, most of the time, reduce infection, especially fungal infection. They're like plant-based antifungals. And plants need antifungals, and so do we. And amazingly, that plants are our little manufacturing centers for all kinds of compounds because plants can't run away from their predators. They have to make chemicals. That's what they do. So they're our little chemical plants. And we are just learning so much from them and gaining so much wisdom and so many bits of healing that it's just totally amazing to me. Normalizing gene expression is something that resveratrol does. And a lot of these plants we're talking about are normalizing. They're modulating and normalizing to function. So they work in what are called amphoteric ways. You know, some plants, like you know, people always say, well, oh, echinacea, how could you give that to somebody with an autoimmune disease? It's going to stimulate their immune system. Well, no, it's not going to stimulate their immune system. It's actually going to help their immune system function appropriately. It's going to help them see more clearly. It's the same thing with the mushroom polysaccharides. You know, these people will say that the theoretical thing is like, well, if in this context A, it did this, then in all other contexts, it will do that. Because, well, that's not true. You need to test that out and tell me that that's true. We just talked about these are the seven different things I talked about. Spleen, liver, kidney, stagnation, phlegm, damn heat toxins. Well, all these things play together. They all get interwoven. And so it becomes really important to understand them all in a way that you can identify how much of them there are present in any person at a given time. And then the whole approach here is the whole medicine, address the whole person, balancing organ networks, and resolve pathological factors. You got to do the two things together. Resolve pathological factors, balance the organ networks. So Sherlock's Corner, we're going to use all the information we can from the spiritual aspect of that person, from the shamanistic perspective, from the perspective of their family, their community, their environment, the perspective of how they interact with you, what's going on in their body, from their pulses, their tongue, your diagnostic tools, their nails, their eyes, their hair, then also looking at their lab work, their pathology, the scans that come with them. What have you seen? Everything you've got, take it all, put it all together, and I call that layering the lenses. And we layer the lenses to focus our image on the goal, which is to create health in that person. And if the images don't get clear, then you need to go back and do some more homework. Because normally you'll find that if you've got your ideas straight and you're gathering all the information, it'll line up and you'll get a real clear focus. Thanks so much, you guys, and we'll do the other one tomorrow.